On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Petroleum Vapor Intrusion, Fundamentals of Screening, Investigation, and Management. Today's training is based on the ITRC online document, Petroleum Vapor Intrusion, Technical and Regulatory Guidance. We're going to introduce you to the training during today's class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Our class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and it's hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. We are recording today's event. The trainers are going to control the slides, but if you want to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where we started today. We do look for your feedback throughout today's training class. At any time, you're welcome to send in a question and a comment using the Q&A box in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, if you're on the phone line, you're welcome to unmute and ask questions out loud. But for asking questions out loud, we do ask you to hold those until the question and answer breaks. But at any time, you're welcome to send in a question using the Q&A pod. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback at the end of today's training. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if you're interested in the certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, because right now the only way to get that certificate is through the feedback form. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. It's a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents. We do have our schedule for 2018 available, both online, and we also are offering a two-day classroom training on petroleum vapor intrusion, and that is October 10 and 11 in the Seattle area. So if that's something you're interested in, visit the ITRC website to read more. Let us know. You can email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll add you to our mailing list and let you know as soon as registration for that class is open. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Team, and you can read bios. And at the link at the bottom of the page will take you to where you can find bios for each of our trainers. Our first trainer today is Matt Williams. He's with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. George Duvall is with Shell. Ian Hers is with Golder Associates. Lauren Lund is with CH2ML, now Jacobs. And we have David Folks with Geosyntec Consultants. I'll now turn the training over to Matt Williams from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Matt?
Thanks, Juliana. So let's start out today by introducing you to our roadmap. This is an overview of today's presentation, and like any good map, we're hoping that it guides you through today's discussion. So I want to start things out by providing a brief introduction on today's class and make sure that you're aware of many of the concepts that we're going to be introducing and discussing in more detail as we progress through the slides today. So let's start out by defining vapor intrusion and discussing how petroleum vapor intrusion fits in. So vapor intrusion is defined by the US EPA as the migration of vapors through the vadose zone and into an overlying building. There are two types of vapor intrusion that can occur. The first is commonly referred to as chlorinated vapor intrusion, or CVI, which deals with solvents. And petroleum vapor intrusion, or PVI, deals exclusively with petroleum hydrocarbons and is why we're here today. There are major differences between these two, the most critical of these differences being aerobic biodegradation. So going on to the next slide, aerobic biodegradation is the breakdown of organic contaminants by microorganisms in the vadose zone and is the defining feature that distinguishes it from chlorinated vapor intrusion. These microorganisms consist of petroleum hydrocarbon degrading bacteria, which are ubiquitous in nature and can be found in all different types of environments. These microorganisms rapidly consume hydrocarbons when oxygen is present and minimizes the migration of petroleum vapors towards a structure and therefore reduces the potential for vapor intrusion to occur. Bottom line, and one that's identified by the graphic on this slide, aerobic biodegradation leads to only a small fraction of petroleum sites requiring some type of vapor control. We use vapor control as a broader form of mitigation, in part because there are different strategies that can be incorporated and different issues that need to be considered for PVI. One issue that we'll talk about further is that there's a good chance that if you have a site that requires a vapor control strategy, there's also a good chance that the system may not be necessary in the future. And for petroleum vapor intrusion, we may need to consider turning it off. CVI, not so much. We typically put in these systems and they run. So if you have to learn nothing else from today, we hope you take away the concept and the idea that a vast majority of sites may be able to be screened out, and the idea that the need for mitigation is significantly less than for CVI, even for those sites that may not immediately be screened out of the process. So what's the big deal? Essentially, historically, there's been a lack of training and guidance for PVI. There isn't a lot out there. Much of the training and guidance document applies mainly to CVI and doesn't consider or address aerobic biodegradation for petroleum hydrocarbons. And we all know that there's a lot of petroleum sites that are out there. The end result is that we try to apply a CVI approach to a petroleum site, which typically results in heightened concerns and may lead to a waste of resources, including staff time and money, on a lot of sites that may have little or no potential for a risk present. For redevelopment or brownfield sites not using an approach tailored for petroleum vapor intrusion, this can lead to costly property transaction delays, either due to unnecessary investigations or the unnecessary construction of presumptive vapor controls. So this is the web-based document that helps guide you through the process for PVI. This is a web-based document that has many features that print doesn't offer, including immediate access to the resources that we use to develop the document, a feature that allows users to piece together the information they need quickly and easily because all the resources are contained within the web page. The ITRC PVI's document, though it serves as a standalone document, it also is a companion document to ITRC's 2007 Vapor Intrusion Pathway, which deals primarily with CVI. It also provides some valuable updates on methods and vapor control strategies that are discussed and how they may be related differently for PVI. The PVI document complements the drafted U.S. EPA OUS PVA guidance, which is currently going through and has been through the review process. It does expand and address many of the different types of petroleum sites where the OUS document is strictly limited to USTs. The intent of using the PVI screening method identified in the document, which is based on a vertical screening distance. It produces consistent and confident decisions that are protective of human health. It minimizes investigative efforts at sites where there are little or no risk of PVI pathway. And finally, the things that we'll discuss is that it helps you prioritize resources for sites, for those sites where the highest risk of vapor intrusion is present. So this ITRC's PVI guidance provides a comprehensive strategy to target those resources for those sites in which the risk from PVI is the greatest. It's an approach developed through a combination of state regulators from over 28 states, consultants, Department of Defense personnel, community stakeholders, and academia from around the country. It is scientifically based, it is credible, and it consistently identifies those sites in which the petroleum vapors may cause a risk and screens out those that don't. It's also applicable to a wide variety of sites, from underground storage tank sites to large refineries and even pipelines. So what's the approach? With your registration, there were some handouts provided, but in case you didn't print it out, you'll see it here on this slide. So So if you're dealing with an explosive situation, if you look at step one, the first thing we need to do is address those emergency response activities. So again, if you're dealing with a high or an explosive situation, high levels of gas like methane or other fire hazards, you need to address those issues first. If you don't have those issues to address, then you can begin implementing the strategy, which includes three phases. The first phase is the site screen using the vertical screening distance, which is a critical component and a unique approach for petroleum vapor intrusion. The second phase is the site investigation, which is more aligned with a typical investigation for vapor intrusion. And the third, if it's necessary, is a vapor control and site management. The ITRC PVI strategy is implemented in 8 steps. If you don't have the handout that was provided, you can print it, but it's also available in the document as two figures, figure 3.2 and figure 4.1. As we go through today, we're going to be going through these steps in more detail, but we wanted to give you a brief overview of the steps. In general, the first three steps, steps 1, 2, and 3, step 1, develop a preliminary conceptual site model. Step 2, evaluate the site for precluding factors. And step 3, screen buildings using a vertical separation distance, is where the steps where the vertical screening distance is applied. The next 5 steps are utilized if the site cannot be vertically screened out and further investigation is warranted. And again, this represents a more traditional site investigative approach. And if you can't rule it out, you can implement a more traditional vapor control strategy. In each of these phases, a CSM, or a site conceptual model, plays a critical component. The ITRC document is applicable to more sites than just gas stations. It was written to address all different types of petroleum sites, which is a main difference between the ITRC document and the EPA's. Appendix E can be easily accessed by clicking on the link at the bottom of this page to provide examples of the types of sites that we have. There is a list in this slide that you can see for yourself. But again, it reaches out and addresses more sites than just underground storage tanks. So in the beginning of the presentation, we asked to see what kind of sites you deal with, and Juliana's going to put that up right now so we can take a look. And you can see that there is that wide range of sites that we see across or that people are dealing with. And it looks like all the categories have it. But like Juliana pointed out, that a majority of the sites that you are interested in or that you're dealing with deal with the underground storage tanks. But we wanted to make sure that you are aware that these other categories, they are part of this document as well. And this document, ITRC's document, will serve as a good resource for those as well. Thank you, Juliana. Another important component of the ITRC's PVI document is that there is a community engagement section. Community engagement is a critical and important component that needs to be weaved throughout the entire PVI process. To that end, there's a series of 4 fact sheets that were prepared to help in public meetings or to give homeowners some important information. Feel free to use these as beginning templates, and like Juliana said, you can reference them as well. Fact sheets are a valuable tool and can be found in Appendix K. You'll hear more about these as they come into play on the roadmap. So today, after the training, our hope is you'll know when and how and where to use ITRC's PVI document, the important role of aerobic biodegradation and what it plays in the PVI pathway, the value of a PVI conceptual site model, or CSM, how to apply ITRC's PVI 8-step decision process, and know when and how to engage with stakeholders. So with that, I am going to turn over to the PVI pathway to George.
Thank you, Matt. The next thing we're going to be looking at in this section is technical and background information on the petroleum vapor intrusion pathway. There's a number of objectives of this section. One of them is looking at the role of biodegradation in PVI and comparing that to chlorinated solvents. We're going to look at the factors that influence aerobic biodegradation of petroleum, namely the c- concentration of the petroleum vapors, having oxygen in the subsurface, and the distance over which the petroleum vapors move. And we're also going to look at the value of a PVI conceptual site model. So what we're going to cover is some basics of vapor intrusion and vapor flow in the subsurface. We'll be looking at some of the differences between chlorinated and petroleum vapor intrusion, in particular that biodegradation, why we're relying on it for attenuation. We're going to be looking at some case studies, some data from sites demonstrating some of that biodegradation. And we'll also be looking at some conceptual site models. And I'm going to start with those conceptual site models. This slide shows a number of cartoons, pictures on the right, of different types of conceptual models. All of those have four basic compartments, as listed on the bullets of this slide. One of them's the building, another the foundation. We're looking at a soil layer between the foundation and a subsurface source, and then a subsurface vapor source, which could be residual petroleum or groundwater. Now, there's a number of factors listed next to each of these compartments in the slide, any of which of those could significantly contribute to attenuating vapor movement. What's highlighted here is this aerobic biodegradation, and why we're looking at that is because it's pretty ubiquitous at these sites, and it also significantly attenuates petroleum vapors. Now, this conceptual model is looking at subsurface to indoor air vapor intrusion. There's a number of other ways that vapors may, from chemicals, may get into indoor air. Could be from bringing impacted water into a house, either through a sump or through drinking water. Could be household or commercial products in a building. All these things can bring vapors, petroleum vapors, into a building. And we're not covering those. We're just covering the subsurface to indoor air vapor intrusion pathway. And as well, there's other potential risks at sites, soil exposure, groundwater exposure, and so forth. Again, we're not covering those. We're just looking at the subsurface to indoor air vapor intrusion pathway. I got a poll question up here, and Julianne will start this out. And the idea here, and initially I'd said I was going to make some comparisons between chlorinated and petroleum vapor intrusion. We're just trying to gauge some experience, and the response varies. Some of you've dealt with some chlorinated sites, others not. Thank you, Juliana. I'm going to go on to the next slide, which is looking at those differences. And what you're looking at is some figures from an EPA document, which is up on the left, and that's short, and it could be worth looking at. But a table that summarizes some differences between chlorinated sites and petroleum impacted sites. The big difference is illustrated in the figure around this what's labeled a vapor plume, where for the chlorinated sites on the right, it's a large vapor plume. On the left, it's smaller, and it's surrounded by this aerobic biodegradation zone. And it's this aerobic biodegradation between the vapor and the aerobic soil layer that significantly attenuates petroleum vapors. Now, why are we looking at petroleum biodegradation? Well, a number of different reasons. It's pretty ubiquitous, occurs pretty reliably in soils. It gets started pretty rapidly when a release first occurs. And once it gets going, the degradation itself can pretty rapidly attenuate vapors. And that those points have been known for a while. Is reported in a number of documents. I've got links to a number of EPA or other regulatory documents on this slide. And there's also many publications, peer-reviewed publications that say the same thing. What we're doing here is taking that information on biodegradation and incorporating it into the practical screening of this vapor intrusion pathway. Now, to look at a little bit more detail in terms of what's going on with this aerobic biodegradation, this slide is illustrating the process. Basically, it's starting with petroleum and oxygen, which microbes, many types of bacteria, metabolize, use as food, and generate some waste products, carbon dioxide and water, as well as more microbes. And that's the basic picture of what's going on in soils. There's a couple of key factors which influence vapor migration, petroleum vapor migration in the subsurface. One of them is the concentration of those petroleum vapors. Another is the distance those vapors are migrating the subsurface, and also having oxygen within that layer where the vapors are migrating. Now I'm going to go from here and go back to that conceptual site model, look at the compartments one at a time, starting at the source. And the figure you're looking at is modified from the ITRC document, and essentially it's looking at different types of petroleum products versus their molecular weight range or carbon number range. And there's a red box on this diagram, and it's essentially illustrating where we're seeing the maximum potential for petroleum vapor intrusion. And the lower end of that box is around a carbon number of 5. Essentially, hydrocarbons lighter than that or lower molecular weight than that are so volatile that they don't persist very long. At the upper end of this range, around C11 or so, we're looking at petroleum constituents where the molecular weight's high enough that they're not very volatile. Within that range, we get this maximum PVI potential in a number of products, in particular gasoline, where we have this maximum potential for vapor intrusion occurring. Now, next I'm going to look a little higher, the next compartment up in that conceptual site model, and this is that soil layer. So at the bottom, and it's illustrated on the diagram on the left. So at the bottom of that soil layer, we have a source, hydrocarbon vapors, and they're diffusing upward in the soil layer. And at the top, the soil surface or bottom of foundation, we have oxygen, and it's diffusing down. And where are these coming? Where these come together, the oxygen and the hydrocarbons come together, we get the maximum potential for biodegradation, labeled as this aerobic biodegradation front. And where this biodegradation front occurs varies depending on the hydrocarbon source. So if we have low concentrations, that aerobic biodegradation front occurs deeper in the soil layer, farther from the surface. The vapors have a greater distance to migrate and degrade, less potential for surface vapors. If we have high concentrations of hydrocarbon vapors, that aerobic biodegradation front can occur closer to the surface, can sometimes also intersect the surface where we would have vapors making it all the way to the surface. In terms of looking at that in more detail, I'm showing in this slide a plot of measured data. This coming from a site in South Carolina. And what we see are these complementary profiles of oxygen, and in this case, benzene is a surrogate for hydrocarbons, where they're crossing, where they're coming together, in this case around 4 feet below grade, there's a pretty high gradient decrease in concentration of the benzene vapors. And this type of behavior we see for a lot of different types of hydrocarbons in a lot of different sites. What we've done is taken information from this and backed out rates of just how fast this is occurring, along with a set of other sites and available data.
George, George, I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in here. We have someone on the line who's joined. It sounds like you joined pretty recently. We are picking up background noise from your location, and this only applies to phone line participants. So if you've joined and you're streaming audio on your computer, you're all set. But if you joined on the phone line, our phone line tells you how to unmute the line, but we do not want you to unmute the line. So double check that your phone is muted at your location, because somebody you joined maybe 2 or 3 minutes ago, we're picking up noise from your location. So please double check, and everyone on the phone line, just be sure that your phone is muted at your location. Sorry about that, George. Please go ahead.
I'm sorry, too. It may actually be where I'm at. I'll try to go on. At any rate, let's see. There's a lot of information on this degradation in the ITRC guide. This slide is shown as a figure out of that, which is showing ranges of degradation rates for lots of different petroleum chemicals. The picture here essentially is that the degradation occurs relatively rapidly and consistently. If you need more information or would like more information on that, I'd encourage you to look at the guide. There's a lot of information on this slide. Essentially, the summary of this is that the degradation occurs relatively rapidly. For most of these chemicals, we can get a factor 2 decrease in vapor concentrations over distances of 5 to 50 centimeters. And it's kind of a geometric increase, double the distance, double the decrease. So it's relatively fast. Or not just fast, but over distance, attenuation is relatively rapid. Now, it's not just the degradation, but having the oxygen in the subsurface that's important. And the question really is, can that oxygen get into the subsurface? The oxygen's coming from atmospheric air. There's a lot of oxygen in atmospheric air. If we take those concentrations of oxygen and air along with the ratio of oxygen to hydrocarbon consumption in typical ratios, oxygen air is capable of degrading about 92 million micrograms per cubic meter. So there's a pretty huge capacity of air, oxygen and air to degrade hydrocarbons. Really the question is, can that oxygen get into the subsurface where it's capable of doing this degradation? And the general answer is yes, but it can be limited in some situations. Where we have impermeable building foundations or limited diffusivity through soils with high moisture or low permeability, it can be difficult to get that oxygen into the subsurface. Oxygen can also be limited because of high oxygen demand. Sometimes that's because of the petroleum that we're talking about. It can also be because of other organic matter, soils with higher organic content in the subsurface. But generally, in most cases, we do have sufficient oxygen in the subsurface to significantly degrade hydrocarbons. And I'm starting to wrap up, and I'm going to wrap up by returning to this conceptual site model, similar to what we had initially, but in this case, adding this oxygen from flow from the subsurface down and illustrating that can significantly degrade these petroleum hydrocarbons. So what else? I've covered a lot of technical information in this set of slides. There's also information in terms of communicating what's going on, and a lot of information on that in the PVI guide that could help answer the questions that are on this slide. And when you're dealing with people, dealing with neighbors at sites, these questions will come up. I'd encourage you to go to that guide and consult some of these fact sheets that are in that guide. And so with that, I'm going to, summarize. We've talked about the conceptual site model, looked at degradation, getting oxygen into the subsurface, and also this community engagement. And with that, I'm going to wrap up and pass it to Ian Hers.
Thanks very much, George. Juliana, can you hear me?
I can. Thank you.
Thank you. We are going to move on to site screening. This is an important part of the PVI process. It's an integral part of the guidance, and in the next 25 minutes or so, I'm going to describe the conceptual site model and summarize the empirical basis for screening, so the data that was collected to support that approach. I'm going to lead you through that stepwise approach in some detail and provide a brief case study. So our learning objectives today are to really help you understand the basis for that site screening and how to implement that approach, and help you understand how this screening approach could potentially be applied at perhaps sites that you're managing or as a regulator you're reviewing site submissions. So this is a new method for PVI screening, and it really is a novel and effective way of quickly evaluating sites based on a vertical screening distance. It's the minimum soil thickness between a petroleum vapor source and a building foundation necessary to effectively result in attenuation of hydrocarbon vapors to below levels of concern for PVI. And again, it's based on empirical data and modeling studies. And this approach is really expected to improve the screening basis and really help screen out those low-risk sites and then help prioritize and focus those resources on the higher-risk sites. This is on slide 45, the conceptual model of the vertical screening distances. And this is a really key starting point to our guidance. And I'm going to just, on the left-hand side, just draw your attention to the actual vertical distances. So this is what we came up with, 15 feet for LNAPL sites that were the smaller UST, AST sites, 18 feet for the larger industrial sites, and 5 feet for dissolved sites, regardless of the site type. And so as you can see, we divided that up into LNAPL and dissolved phase. LNAPL conceptual model is that there could be either residual LNAPL or mobile continuous phase. There is volatilization, movement of vapors, oxygen moving down from the surface, and a aerobic biodegradation interface. And those interfaces often occur over relatively short distances. But the whole, intent of our guidance was to identify that screening distance. We also, of course, looked at dissolved phase sources, and the main difference there is that we have a saturated zone with dissolved concentrations, movement through a capillary fringe, and then the aerobic biodegradation interface tends to be much closer to the source. And that's because of the attenuation that occurs through the capillary fringe and the much lower concentrations in the deep vado zone compared to an LNAPL source. And so that is based on extensive data. And so this distinction was really supported and important for moving forward with the guidance. Excuse me. The basis for the site screening, again, is a large body of empirical data that was collected between about 1995 and 2001. I'd like to just, first of all, give credit to Robin Davis, a regulator from the state of Utah, who actually started this process, collected data from the state of Utah and a number of other states. That work was then subsequently kind of continued on by US EPA and also some of the colleagues from Shell who looked at the data and other agencies and companies. But there was a significant effort to collect additional data to better understand these relationships. So there were paired measurements of contaminant source strength, groundwater concentrations typically, and associated vapor data. We obtained the data from hundreds of sites, from a wide range of types of sites, geographies, environmental and site conditions, and really the analysis showed consistent and predictable vapor attenuation through biodegradation over relatively short distances. mostly gasoline sites. There's about half a dozen diesel sites. One thing that's not noted here, it really isn't quite important, is that quite a bit of the data was collected below buildings. In fact, 38 sites had data, soil gas concentrations below buildings. Some other of the sites had concentrations below the slabs, you know, pavement. This was important to better understand the potential for the so-called oxygen shadow. And actually what the results showed is that regardless of the surface cover, there was attenuation occurring, and that had no significant effect on the results. And so we felt that the analysis actually showed that these empirical relationships and the screening distances that were developed would apply to a range of sites. And then there was the analysis conducted for those three different site types, again, dissolve phase, UST, AST, LNAPL sites, and then the larger petroleum industrial sites. I also want to emphasize, actually, I was part of this process on contract for EPA. We spent much time looking at data quality and actually filtering and removing poor quality data. So there were, again, a number of, quality control checks, and quite a bit of the data that was obtained was of, we felt, of research quality. So it was actually studies were the studies were carefully conducted. This shows the location of the sites and the number of sites. So mostly in the U.S., there are a few sites in Canada, with 74 sites, and this is the U.S. EPA database, 893 benzene vapor measurements. A number of references there are shown, and actually it starts with Robin Davis's work, and then there were a few other researchers, and some of the data was similar. Some of it was from different sources. For example, the study by Jackie Wright, the Australian data, was a completely separate database. We actually looked at it for EPA as well. Large data set, over 1,000 measurements. I think the important finding was, regardless of the data set and the specific analysis method, although all the studies follow similar approaches, but regardless, the outcomes were very similar with respect to the screening distances. So again, increase the confidence of this approach. This is just a quick slide just showing the US EPA database, the number of soil vapor analyses for different analytes. It was important that we also looked at compounds beyond BTEX. So we looked at, for example, naphthalene, hexane, heptane. We also looked at TPH fractions, so the made-up fractions. So we were fortunate to be able to collect that data for a number of sites. And the outcome actually was that benzene was the risk driver. So based on the reference concentrations or the regulatory limits for these different compounds, we found that benzene was the driver. The empirical data analysis was conducted based on a probability-based methods. So we compared those soil vapor concentrations to risk-based thresholds for varying vertical distances. So we, again, in the schematic there, we have a ruler, and what we're showing is the vertical distance above an LNAPL or dissolved site and concentrations that are decreasing in time, or sorry, in space. And the threshold is shown there, and so that threshold is estimated based on regulatory limits and an attenuation factor of 0.01. And so that was felt to be appropriate. It's a reasonable attenuation factor for the purposes of our study. We had a number of non-detect data, and that was addressed through two methods, a substitution method, so half the detection limit, or the Kaplan-Meier method. And the Kaplan-Meier method is used in survival statistics and health sciences, and actually more recently now is can be used for environmental data. It's a powerful method to deal with data with varying detection limits and part of the EPA Pro UCL package. And so that was used to also evaluate the non-detect data. I'm going to just lead you through a few slides to show you the highlights of the results. This is for benzene, a dissolved source, and on the vertical axis we have benzene vapor concentration, log scale, and then we have the distance between the soil vapor probe and the contamination. So in this case, that's the water table, and we were careful to evaluate the data and choose the high water table condition. As you can see, the benzene vapor concentration decreases with increasing distance, and the vertical screening distance was determined to be, for the ITRC work, 5 feet for dissolved phase. And benzene was the risk driver, requires the greatest distance to attenuate. Okay, moving on, just the probability plot. So this is the probability. The vapor concentration was less than the threshold. Regardless of the method, it started at about 92 to 97% and increased with increasing distance. So a high level of confidence in this method. Moving quickly, now we're just going to look at the LNAPL source. These are the UST-AST sites. You can see much higher benzene vapor concentrations. And there is those significant attenuation. As you can see, by 15 feet, those concentrations decrease. And the vertical screening distance was determined to be 15 feet for LNAPL. Data not shown for the industrial sites. There certainly is less data there. Greater uncertainty, I think, with the results, that's fair to say. But based on the available data, the distance was 18 feet. And again, benzene required the greatest distance to attenuate. This is, again, the corresponding probability plot showing the increase in probability with increasing distance between the soil vapor probe and the contamination source, which in this case is the top of the residual LNAPL zone. So I've led you through a number of analyses that was performed. I do want to just draw your attention to these results, which were actually put together by George Duvall. One of the questions that came up sort of after we've done the initial analysis and come up with the relationship shown on previous slides is, what about lower benzene concentration thresholds? And so one of the things that I should have mentioned on the previous slide was, for benzene, the relationships I showed were based on regulatory limits of between 50 and 100 micrograms per meter cubed. So this is a sole gas threshold. In some regulatory jurisdictions, the actual sole gas screening levels are slightly lower. And of course, that depends on the some of the assumptions for acceptable risk and attenuation factors and so forth. But it was important to look at this a little bit further. And so what George did is he started to look at different benzene sole gas screening levels, starting with 100 and going to 5, and redid the analysis. I actually found that there was, you know, some slight differences, but really no significant deviation from the findings previously determined. And so, as you can see, even if you decrease that benzene sole gas screening level, it only has a slight effect on the screening distance. And so the overall conclusion was that the vertical screening distances were protective for even very low sole gas screening levels. So now I'd like to move on to the next section of the presentation, which is the application of the screening process. We have a three-step process. This is a figure 3.2 from the guidance. It's first of all to develop a CSM for site screening. Step two is to determine whether there are precluding factors, and if there are, then we move on to conducting a further PVI investigation, which Lauren will describe. However, if there aren't precluding factors, we then look whether the current building or future building is located within the lateral inclusion zone. If it is, then we move on to the vertical screening distances. And so, as you can see, if those lateral or vertical screening distances are met, then no further PVI evaluation is necessary. Well, let's move through the different steps. First of all, we develop a CSM, and George has already provided a lot of great information on this. So again, to quickly go over this, it's helpful to look at this with respect to a source pathway receptor framework. For PVI, it's important to understand the site type, whether it's a USP or larger type of site. We look at the petroleum vapor source, LNAP versus dissolved, the extent of the source, precluding factors, and then the lateral inclusion zone and vertical screening distance. So that are the key data that we look for. To unpack this a little bit more, let's just talk about each one. Site type, again, we look at petroleum UST AST sites. So these are service station sites, are similar. And then petroleum industrial sites. And those are terminals, multiple tanks, larger tanks typically, refineries and pipelines. Really, we think that the differences in the screening and some of the observed differences that I've seen at some case studies I've looked at for larger sites is really related to the volume of the spill and the extent of contamination. And so when you have very large spills, at that point there may become greater limitations with respect to oxygen, and consequently the screening distances are higher. And so I want to point this out. Just when you look at your CSM, if you do even have like a service station site with a very large, you know, catastrophic type, you know, release, very large release, you may wish to be careful with your CSM just to make sure that you have categorized your site correctly. So the next step is to look at the source. And again, we look at LNAP versus dissolved phase sources, and we really recommend a multiple lines of evidence approach. And of course, there are direct indicators that are fairly obvious, LNAP and sheen and soil boring logs that indicate the presence of product. There are indirect indicators as well that can be used, and those are things like concentrations or PID readings, and even things like near continuous soil cores with PID readings can be really effective in seeing where an LNAP zone starts, for example. And we've summarized these in Table 3.1. I'll show that table in a moment, and so that's, I think, a really effective aid in just looking at your source. And it's, again, I want to point out is that your LNAP source includes both sites with mobile LNAP, where you see LNAP in wells, and sites with just residual LNAP. And so it is important to do a thorough evaluation for the LNAP source. Well, here's Table 3.1. And just draw your attention to a few things. Like, for example, benzene concentrations greater than about 1 to 5 milligrams per liter are indicative of an LNAP source, and at least for gasoline. And you know, conversely, or I guess complementary, is the TPH gasoline concentration greater than 30 milligrams per liter. Also, would be indicative of an LNAP source. Some of the other effective ways of looking at a site are LIF profiles, if you have them, PID readings. Can be effective, and one of the other things is historical data, location relative to your UST. If you're looking at a site and you're right in the tank nest or where the pump islands were, or where there's known, you know, fairly intensive potential for small spills and so forth, that could certainly influence your understanding of the source zone. So again, it's really based on a multiple lines of evidence approach. Extent of the source, delineation is extensive or essential, and the top of the LNAP in groundwater and soil and smear zones should be determined, as well as your dissolved plume. And we would suggest that you should look at the edge of the plume with respect to maximum concentration limits. We recognize that these may not be based on the vapor intrusion pathways, but they're often relatively low concentrations that provide a guide or detection limits or other criteria. Again, we acknowledge that there may be state regulations or guidance that would aid in the definition of the dissolved plume. Next is precluding factors. This is an important one, and there certainly are a number that could potentially exist at your site. And first of all are preferential pathways. It could be natural, karst, or fractured geology. For this one, we have a really nice conceptual model, which I'll show in a moment. Anthropogenic, sealed, poorly sealed utility lines. Again, I'll show that. If we have an expanding or advancing plume, that is where, of course, you'd want to be really careful in applying this guidance. And we would just recommend that you look at the ALMAPL guidance. And this has just been recently updated, and it's out. So this is now 2018. It's new and improved, and lots of really good information there. Next is certain field types. Been a relatively extensive work that I've been involved in, working with the American Petroleum Institute and a number of companies, agencies, to try to better understand lead scavengers. And so these are ethylene dibromide, or 1,2-dichloroethane. These were historically added to gasoline. And they, at least the understanding and thought was that they might behave differently than benzene or BTEX, and they're chlorinated compounds. And there's been a fair bit of work with respect to database and some field sites that were collecting data. Actually, we're right in the middle of a project, and I think it's fair to say that our initial findings are that the behavior of these chlorinated compounds may not be significantly different relative to BTEX, in that they do biodegrade both aerobically and anaerobically in the vadozone, and that we may not have additional concern or risk associated with these compounds. And consequently, I think we may be in the near future at the point where we can say that these compounds do not require kind of a special or an assessment outside of the PVI screening. So, that's still ongoing work, but we're really excited about that. The other aspect to look at is the ethanol, and we did a study on ethanol, and our conclusion was that up to 10% ethanol did not result in sufficient added biodegradation demand. Ethanol is, the bugs love it, they do biodegrade it aerobically, nor would it, enhance vapor migration through, for example, advection through pressure gradients. And so we don't want to spend too much time on this or a whole separate technical topic, but the conclusion was that ethanol would not be an issue. And then certain soil types. If you have very high organic content, it can present a natural oxygen demand through the oxidation of those natural organics, or very dry soils. We know that the biodegradation rates go down, but these soils have to be certainly at the wilting point and extremely dry. And I just want to point out is that we had just a bunch of sites from Utah and California, fairly dry areas. We did not see reduced biodegradation rates or higher attenuation distances. And so, again, I think by and large, most sites would not fall in those categories for the last category shown there. So here's the conceptual model for the fractured site, and really here we're concerned about fast movement of vapors through perhaps even pressure gradients connecting ALMAPL to cracks in a foundation and indoor airspace. So these sites would be precluded. And then on the right-hand side is a utility. And this has been a really interesting development over the last few years. A lot of data is being now collected on migration of vapors in utilities. And I think we're still learning things, and we need to consolidate the data and the improved knowledge in this area. I think conceptually, though, the concern is where you have a direct connection between a utility and for example, an ALMAPL source, and the indoor airspace of a building. And that's where you may see some elevated concentration. So certainly some professional judgment involved. There are ways and approaches for sampling utilities and manholes that may be, in some cases, appropriate. The one thing I'd like to say is that most of the data and concern that I have seen with utilities is being focused around chlorinated hydrocarbons. And there may be some differences just between those compounds and petroleum in terms of their persistence and their concern with respect to utilities. And so, but again, it is important to look at this and understand how utilities might affect vapor intrusion at your site. The next step in the CSM was to look at that lateral inclusion zone. I think we kind of have discussed that. We established it as 30 feet, and the rationale for that was, well, you know, vapors will attenuate over much shorter distances because we think the vertical distance of, for example, 5 feet from a dissolved phase point would also apply, you know, laterally, but we know that there's also practical limitations in the spacing of wells and your delineation of your site contamination. So 30 feet was considered to be a reasonable kind of compromise, so to speak. The next is to develop that or understand the vertical separation distance, how that applies, and we want to point out is that, you know, for a dissolved phase source, you know, you have water table fluctuations, and so that's important to understand. You know, if we have seasonal variability, we really want to define that from the top of the kind of the water table based on the seasonal changes. So the next step was to determine, as part of step two, precluding factors shown on previous slides. If no precluding factors, determine if you're within the lateral inclusion zone. And then finally, in step three, we conduct a screening with the vertical separation distance. So again, this is a summary on the left-hand side. And I like the conceptual model on the right because, again, it provides a little bit more information and understanding of how to apply these. So we have a former UST right beside the building there, and that's there was a release, and that moved down to a perching unit. And as you can see, there's some residual in the vadose zone. And so your distance set is from the top of that residual. So it's, again, important to sufficiently characterize your sites so that you understand your source and how to apply those vertical distances. Well, we're wrapping up here now with just a quick case study, and this is the Santa Clara site data that was provided to us by Robin Davis. And the first step, of course, is to develop the CSM. The site was deemed to be in the area of impact, which was limited to dissolve phase. So the benzene concentration at this particular location was just under 1 milligram per liter. So it's elevated, but there were no other, you know, indicators or signs of residual mobile LNAPL, so based on the soil cores and the well monitoring that was conducted. So dissolve phase site. Step two, precluding factors. There were no preferential pathways. The plume was stable and shrinking, so there was actually historical data, time series data that showed that, and there's no lead scavengers, and within or up to 10% ethanol. Actually, one thing I do want to point out that I neglected to early on when I just went over the empirical database is that we think that quite a number of the sites that are in the database actually had up to 10% ethanol. So again, another kind of sign or piece of evidence that we think supports the inclusion of these sites. The next step with respect to this site was, are we within the lateral inclusion distance? And the answer is yes. And then finally, step three, do we have sufficient vertical separation? And the dissolve phase was about 7.7 feet below the basement slab. And so in Utah, through the DEQ process, they determined the PVI pathway as not complete. And there was no further investigation that was needed. So At this point, I'm going to bring it back to Juliana for questions.
Thanks, Ian. We do now have a few minutes for your questions, so everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to jump in with questions. I'll also remind you at this point, at the end of today's class, we do look for you to fill out the feedback form. We really do appreciate your feedback, and if you need to access that before we get to the last slide, in the middle right, those related URLs, the last one is the feedback. You select the name feedback, and then you look down a bit and select browse to, and that's going to allow that feedback form to open in a new window for you. We have a question that came in earlier. How does MTBE fit into the degradation picture? What is a good source for more information?
Good question. The petroleum chemicals that we've been talking about and the degradation we're talking about is aerobic. There are other chemicals that degrade aerobically. MTBE is one of them. The lead scavengers that Ian just talked about are two other chemicals that degrade aerobically. For MTBE, there's actually aerobic degradation rates in the biovapor model. Tabulated. They're coming out of measured data. Practically, those rates relative to the migration rate of MTBE are relatively low. The degradation itself in this exposure pathway for MTBE is relatively low. But in terms of practical issues with MTBE, the health-based criteria is relatively high, and the odor potential is more likely to be the issue. Now, practically, in terms of having actual issues with MTBE, my experience is not the scenario we've been looking at, which is subsurface vapors through a layer of soil, but actually having a sump, an impacted sump with impacted groundwater in there, where you're bringing the water into the building enclosure, and the issue tends to be vapors. I'm sorry, the issue tends to be odors, vapor odors. So I hope that helped.
Another question came in. Will the course slides be available to participants by email or link following the webinar? And they are available right now. So looking at the middle right, related URLs, if you go to the additional resources, and again, select additional resources, look down, select browse to, the first item there is going to allow you to download the presentation. So thanks for asking. Our next question, Veda soil is often a source. How does that fit in the CSM?
George, I can maybe start with just an acknowledgement that, yes, that's important. Certainly it is possible, and I did mention sources in the Vado zone at former UST sites and, you know, areas of tanks and infrastructure and the conceptual example shown. And so it is important to characterize your site such that you understand where those sources are located and then appropriately apply the vertical screening distances. So I'm not sure if there's more to that question, but hopefully that provides an answer.
And this is Matt from the state of Michigan. I'll add a little bit. We would treat that in Michigan, unless you make a demonstration that it's not NAPL, we would typically apply the NAPL screening distance because the release occurred from NAPL, so that's what you would most likely expect.
Thank you. Is gravel fill within utility trenches, which may be a preferential pathway for contaminants, a consideration?
I'll quickly jump in. Gravel is a possible pathway. I think the studies with chlorinated hydrocarbons have shown that it's generally the sewer itself, which is a much more important pathway. If we look at petroleum compounds, and if they were moving in gravel, there's also very high potential for oxygen to move in that same gravel pathway. And so I don't think we see a real concern with respect to gravel being, a pathway for vapor. It certainly is potentially a pathway for LMAP sites at some sites. So you may want, you'd want to look at that, but I don't think it's necessarily a special precluding case for a PVI assessment.
Like Ian was saying too, this is Matt again. You could get the NAPL extending down in those gravel layers depending on what the surrounding soils were. In Michigan, we find that that's more of a CVI issue. For like what Ian was talking about, is you have a lot more oxygen in those trenches, so you're not really going to see it extend laterally through just the outside of the pipe. But if you have that source material inside the pipe, you will definitely get that vapor transport directly into the building.
Have the studies that Ian talked about included LEL levels approaching or exceeding explosive levels in buildings?
Julianne, could you repeat that question? I'm not sure I understood it.
So have the studies included LEL levels approaching or exceeding explosive levels in buildings?
George, jump in, please. Yeah.
There's multiple maybe answers to that. The source zone concentrations in the studies that were cited have been, some of them have been very high. That said, with a layer of soil between the source zone and the building, actually seeing LEL levels inside in a building haven't happened. You need that conduit or the flammable hydrocarbons themselves inside the building for that to happen.
The guidance, very reasonably, has focused on benzene. However, can you discuss the significance of APH results showing low benzene but high C9 to C10 and C9 to C12?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So part of our database includes data on the made-up fractions. I think that's what's being referred to. And that data was evaluated based on the appropriate toxicity-based reference concentrations for those fractions. And the distances were estimated. And those distances were smaller than those for benzene. It may depend on the regulatory jurisdiction and the exact screening concentrations that are applied to those fractions, but based on the work that we conducted, the benzene was the risk driver. So certainly we looked at the fractions.
And there may be two parts to that answer. One of them dealing with what Ian was saying, which is those screening distances appear to be protective for benzene as well as the other constituents in petroleum, as well as these petroleum fractions. And that was looked at initially, and I know Matt Lavis had done it again. There's a different part to that question, which is if you don't meet those screening distances, if you have a source inside that distance, the chemicals of potential concern can be benzene, can also be the other constituents in petroleum. And there may be instances where we have a source, no benzene, very close proximity to a building. Yes. The driving chemical could be something other than benzene, could be one of these petroleum fractions.
After a risk assessment, we have a hazard map with indoor inhalation. We recommend investigating the vapors at 100 feet for chlorinated. How does that work for hydrocarbons?
This is kind of a broad hazard mapping. And, you know, with a CVI or chlorinated vapor intrusion example of 100 feet, I mean, the corresponding distance for PVI is 30 feet. And so, but there's the added component of the vertical distance. And so, you know, I could see conceptually that there, you know, within the screening that I described, there would be, I guess, some benefit to mapping based on 30 feet.
Thank you. We're out of time for this question and answer break, but you are welcome to continue sending in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. And in some cases, the trainers are going to read those questions and respond right back to you. For now, we'll continue on with the second half of today's presentation, and I'm going to turn it over to Lauren Lund at CH2M, now Jacob.
Thank you, Juliana. We're on slide 69. I'm going to be talking about the investigation component of this step in our presentation today. So slide 70, chapter 4 of the document is titled Site Investigation. It does describe a five-step process for investigating petroleum VI, and that's for sites where site screening that Ian just described did not eliminate PVI from further consideration. And there are a number of reasons for the site not screening out that Ian just discussed, including insufficient separation distance, precluding factors, or even regulatory-specific requirements. Most of you know that multiple lines of evidence are needed during a site investigation when investigating vapor intrusion. And the five-step process that has been outlined, that we outlined in Chapter 4's decision flowchart, it is based on a multiple lines of evidence approach. It is up to the investigator, each of you, to collect and understand the different types of data and the information that you need. It really is a good idea to focus your investigation only on the data and the lines of evidence that you need to assess this particular pathway. So site investigation, it starts with step 4. This is a concentration-based evaluation where you're using existing data. If the pathway is not eliminated during step 4, step 5 involves selecting the applicable conceptual site model scenario and the corresponding sampling approach. The data are then evaluated in step 6, and since PVI is an iterative process, you as the investigator determine in step 7 whether the pathway is complete. We've mentioned before, but these steps are outlined in figure 4.1, which you can download. It's also in the document. And one note to keep in mind is that you always have the option to decide to implement vapor controls in lieu of further investigation at any time. So we're now on slide 73. Let's make sure I click it. There we go. So this slide summarizes step 4 that I just mentioned, where you compare your existing concentrations with your screening level. These screening levels do vary by state or region and also by stakeholder, so it is important to check with your regulatory agency to make sure you're using the applicable screening levels. You can also refer to the IGRC's Spring 2012 PVI State Survey, where we've summarized in Appendix A. I should say we've included in Appendix A and summaries in there. Comparing with screening levels can help you determine if additional PVI evaluation is needed. I do want to point out and remind you that this concentration-based screening step, it is independent of the vertical screening distance method that Ian just described. Step 5, it involves selecting the scenario that best fits your site, along with designing the investigative approach that you're going to take. Your site should fit under either scenario 1, which is where your contamination is not in contact with the building, or scenario 2, where your contamination may be in contact with the building. There are a few other scenarios that I'll mention here in just a few minutes. The type of the investigation strategy that you select, it does depend on the scenario that's specific to your site. As a reminder, regulatory agencies, they often do have requirements or guidance that's specific for this vapor intrusion pathway, or they may rely solely on EPA guidance. So understanding the applicable regulatory requirements, it is an important part of designing a successful site investigation. Slide 75. For scenario 1, so let's start with scenario 1. This is where your contamination is not in contact with the building. We would expect that the initial investigation approach that you're most likely going to select would be soil gas sampling. And that's because soil gas data are reflective of the fate and transport processes that George just described in the VADO zone between your contamination source and the building. And those things include partitioning, sorption, and biodegradation. Now, some of the alternative approaches that you could apply in this step would include collection of groundwater, soil, subslab soil gas, or indoor and outdoor air data. For scenario 2, and remember that's where you have contamination in direct contact with the building, it may not be possible to collect subslab soil gas samples, and that's because of soil saturation, for example. Therefore, we would expect that the initial investigation approach would most likely be indoor air or crawl space sampling along with concurrent outdoor air sampling. There are alternative strategies. They are less common, but you might collect samples within the slab, or you might use flux chambers. You could also collect some sump water samples if it exists, or headspace vapor samples if those sumps are present. However, my experience has been that interpreting these data can be quite technically challenging when you're using alternative methods. So make sure you get consensus with your regulators along with your stakeholders on how the data collected using the alternative approaches would be interpreted. This slide shows the investigative options for the other scenarios that I mentioned that are listed on Figure 4.1. So for a site with intermittent petroleum odors, and again, assuming this is not an emergency situation, your initial investigation approach would most likely be a building walkthrough followed by some indoor air sampling to verify the presence of petroleum hydrocarbons. If you do verify their presence, that might trigger a more detailed investigation. For undeveloped lots, the groundwater, soil, or soil gas methods that I described for scenario 1 would apply, and that's because the structure sampling is not possible. If you do have significant preferential pathways or you suspect them, the initial approach would most likely be indoor air sampling. There are some alternatives for scenarios where you have potentially significant preferential pathways, and they might include things like soil gas sampling within the utility bedding, soil permeability testing, or even direct utility conduit air sampling, which have been mentioned already by Ian and George. For sites where you have commingled contaminant plumes, meaning petroleum and chlorinated, we would refer you to the IHRC 2007 vapor intrusion guidance. I just wanted to pause on slide 78 for a moment and remind you all about the toolbox that we produce that's Appendix G in the guidance. It is a great resource. It does provide many more details on the site investigation methods than what I could talk about today or even include in Chapter 4. It does provide answers to many of the what, how, and why questions you might have. It also includes some videos, step-by-step instructions. It lists the various analytical methods and much more. So I do highly recommend you or your contractors take the time to review this appendix. And that's important, especially during work planning. Step 6 is the data evaluation step. And that's where the completeness and the significance of the PVI pathway are assessed. So make sure you're considering data quality, such as your detection limits and sampling errors. The multiple lines of evidence evaluation steps that I show here, they're described in detail in the 2007 ITRC vapor intrusion guidance. And they include things such as comparing concentrations with your screening levels. Those screening levels could be based on default assumptions, empirical data, or even modeled attenuation. We're going to have a little bit of a discussion here shortly on modeling. So it is important, though, when you're looking at the published values for screening or comparison, that you do account for bioattenuation and determine if they've accounted for it. And that's because many of the sites, we do find that petroleum vapor intrusion is not an issue if bioattenuation has been properly accounted for. Another reminder, just to make sure you're accounting for potential bias from background sources when you do evaluate indoor air data. And then also make sure you're considering both the individual along with the cumulative strength of the lines of evidence. So consider multiple lines of evidence and consider the strength that's reflected in those lines of evidence. Some lines are better, lines of evidence are better than others. All right, we're on slide 80 here, step 7. So step 7 does reflect that iterative nature of the investigation process, and particularly when you're trying to determine if the site's been adequately characterized and whether you need additional investigation. Some of the other questions you want to think about during this step include whether the site contaminants have been properly delineated, whether PVI has been assessed at all of the potentially affected buildings, whether you do have enough data to reach a vapor control decision at the site. If you do conclude that you've got some data gaps, it may be necessary to collect some additional data, and you would use the methods I just summarized, or refer to Appendix G, like I mentioned, for additional tools. That could include things like evaluating building construction, HVAC operation, vapor flux, a number of things. Step 8, once you have determined that you've got sufficient data, the final step then is to determine the completeness of the pathway. So if the pathway is incomplete, then no further evaluation is necessary. Matt mentioned how the expectation is that many sites would screen out. However, if the pathway is complete with a potential for unacceptable risks, then you really should consider implementing the vapor control approaches that we'll discuss here shortly. I do want to provide a case study here on slide 82 for the next couple slides. This site is a gasoline diesel site in Salina, Utah, courtesy of the Utah DEQ. Groundwater is at 20 feet below ground surface. The site does have silty sand and fine-grained sand lithology. The petroleum hydrocarbon releases were from dispensers, product lines, and USTs. So slide 83, steps 1, 2, and 3 from chapter 3 involved developing the preliminary conceptual site model, determining that there were no precluding factors and that the building was within 30 feet laterally from the dissolved and the LNAPL sources, and ultimately concluding that the petroleum VI pathway could not be eliminated as a possibility. And if you look at this picture, that was because the top of the LNAPL was 5 feet below the slab, with insufficient vertical separation. Therefore, further investigation was warranted, and we moved into a detailed site investigation. So on slide 84, a concentration-based evaluation, and that's step four, it indicated that the benzene near slab soil gas concentrations exceeded the EPA vapor intrusion screening levels, and you can see the concentrations were as high as 270,000 right there next to the building, shallow soil gas, and that then triggered additional investigation. The agency opted to conduct concurrent subslab soil gas sampling. Oh, before I say that, though, I've already said it, but the site does fit within the scenario one that I described where your contamination is not in contact with the building. So concurrent subslab soil gas indoor and outdoor air sampling was selected as the strategy for this site, and it was conducted during two separate events. So I'm on slide 87. Although step six, or this is where we evaluated the data, determined that the indoor and outdoor air non-detect concentrations were greater than a 1 times 10 to the minus 6 target risk level, both the detected and the non-detected indoor air concentrations were similar to the 10 to the minus 5 vapor intrusion screening levels used by the Utah DEQ. So staff at the UDEC also noted that the indoor and outdoor air concentrations were quite similar, suggesting the possibility of a background outdoor air source. So if you look at the subslab concentrations here, you'll see that they're relatively low source strength, even though the exterior shallow soil gas was quite high. And this represents a relatively low source strength when you're beneath the slab. And that's due to the type of attenuation, bioattenuation, that we typically observe. So it was concluded then during step seven that additional investigation was not warranted. And during step eight, we concluded that the pathway was not complete, and that's because the indoor air concentrations were similar to the applicable risk-based screening levels. They were non-detect, or they were similar to the outdoor air concentrations. So for this particular site, vapors have significantly bioattenuated from that relatively shallow NAPL source, and the measured indoor air concentrations are likely due to background sources. One more slide before I sum things up here. It's just a reminder that it's important to engage your stakeholders through the investigation process. And I do list some of the likely questions that building occupants or other stakeholders will ask during a PVI investigation, particularly if you're knocking on their door and entering their structures. Things will definitely go smoother if you're proactive and you answer these questions early in the process. And as Matt mentioned, we'd refer you to Chapter 7 for more details on engaging your stakeholders. So in summary, make sure you know the applicable regulatory requirements when you're designing a detailed investigation. Take a multiple lines of evidence approach. Apply that five-step process that's outlined in the decision flowchart. Make sure you're using Appendix G, the toolbox in there, and to guide your expected or alternative investigation methods that you may select. And then lastly, make sure you're communicating with your stakeholders. So I'm going to turn it back over to Ian, and he's going to talk about modeling.
Thanks very much, Lauren. We're going to now move on to modeling. So we're on slide 92, and we're going to, first of all, look at the overview and learning objectives for modeling. We're going to touch on why we would use models and the process to follow when conducting a PVI modeling study. And we're going to spend some time describing the BioVapor model, and illustrate its use through case studies. Our learning objectives for this section are to really determine if modeling is an applicable step in the PVI pathway evaluation at your site, and to understand what BioVapor is often the appropriate choice for evaluating the pathway, and to ask the appropriate questions. I'd like to refer you to Chapter 5 of the guidance in Appendix H and I, and there's lots of great information there, lots of details and on how to use models and inputs. Really, our intent here is to provide a brief overview of modeling. We're not intending to provide much in the way of detail. Again, it's just to develop an initial understanding of how you could use models and some considerations. So first of all, why use models to evaluate PVI? Well, first of all, if we do fail the screening process, so we are conducting further assessment, we can use a model to predict health risk, and conversely, to derive cleanup goals based on acceptable risk. And so we could derive soil gas or groundwater concentrations using a model. Of course, we can also do that with regulatory attenuation factors, but we think in some cases a model that includes biodegradation is actually a better approach. We can use a model to just understand processes and key factors, conduct what-if analyses, understand perhaps the controlling mechanisms and input parameters for biodegradation. Another example, it's not a common one, but it has been considered, is how much oxygen do I need for a mitigation? So if there is extensive vapor flux to near a building, one strategy could be to add sufficient oxygen to degrade hydrocarbons. And then modeling was used to support the vertical screening distances. So vapor transport modeling can be used to evaluate faint transport of vapors through a subsurface source of ozone and potentially into indoor air. Three model types can be used to evaluate PVI. First of all, there are empirical models, and perhaps not the conventional idea of models, but they are a model in a sense. So we can take empirical data and develop relationships. Well, the example is the vertical screening distance. Second is analytical models. These are mathematical equations based on simplifications of site conditions. And the common example that I'm sure many of you are aware of is the Johnson Energy Model. The BioVapor model builds on that analytical model, and we'll describe it shortly. And then finally, numerical models. They allow potentially for more realistic simulation of multidimensional transport and more complex site conditions. And for example, variability based on soil property and variation in conditions at a site. Due to the level of data and effort to increase cost, they're rarely used for conventional PVI assessments. They have been instrumental in some research studies and developing guidance to further or better understand PVI processes and attenuation. So they certainly have served a useful purpose in that regard. With respect to the acceptability of models, that is an ongoing question, and I'm not aware of any recent, very recent surveys, but there was one that was conducted in 2010, and it asked the question to various state regulators, the acceptance and use of vapor intrusion modeling. In 11 states, it was potentially, or it could be potentially, the sole basis for eliminating the PVI pathway as a line of evidence in investigation in 7 states. And in 8 states, specifically indicated modeling requires confirmatory sampling. And so we point this out just to illustrate there is a varying acceptance and regulations regarding use of models, and we encourage you to be aware and with respect to federal or state requirements in the jurisdiction that you're working in. This slide shows a framework for using models, and I think it's important to follow a framework like this. Of course, it depends on the complexity and the nature of the project, but to varying degrees, all projects should consider this. First of all, defining the problem and your objectives, reviewing your CSM, select the model consistent with the CSM. And for example, if you have a site with fractured bedrock or some unusual conditions, the models that we're describing in this section would not apply, and it may not be conducive to modeling, or it may just require a different model. It'd be quite a complex one, but again, we just need to make sure that the model is consistent with the CSM, determine your inputs, compare your model predictions to available data. In some contexts, for example, groundwater modeling, calibration is often referred to. We think that that generally is probably an unrealistic goal to calibrate a model. However, if you do have soil gas data along the vapor intrusion pathway, potentially even indoor air data that is carefully used, which is because the indoor air could be affected by background and it's quite variable, you can conduct or make comparisons, and that may be useful. And then finally, conduct a sensitivity analysis on key parameters. So, BioVapor model, it's available through the American Petroleum Institute at the link there. I just want to point out is that EPA is developing their own kind of version. I mean, it's very similar to the BioVapor model. It has a probabilistic component, and we just want to make you aware that that is being developed as well. Back to BioVapor, why use it? Well, to quantify the contribution of aerobic biodegradation. Relatively easy to use, has built-in parameter databases. George mentioned that, is that, for example, degradation rates, chemical properties, so has a useful database. Model characteristics, built on the same conceptual framework. It's the Johnson and Anderson model, but includes oxygen-limited aerobic biodegradation. Similar caveats to model use, it's an order of magnitude predictor. It's not a precise predictor of vapor intrusion and indoor air concentrations, and so it needs to be used appropriately. Some key inputs, the oxygen boundary condition, we're going to discuss that momentarily. First order decay constants, George touched on that in his presentation, and the baseline respiration rate, I mentioned that in the screening. That can be important if you have high organic content. Source concentrations, of course, are also very important. So oxygen in the BioVapor model, there are three options. First of all, you can specify the oxygen concentration below the foundation, and this might be appropriate if you had a crawl space or you have a known boundary condition, so to speak, for oxygen. Secondly, you can let the model balance the flux and the oxygen consumption. And what we mean by that is if, for example, you have ejection occurring, and that is a common process and often characterized by the so-called Q-soil value, and that's the amount of soil gas that's being drawn up into the building, well, that soil gas has oxygen. It sourced from atmosphere beside the building, as shown in the little CSM. And so really what the model just does is it includes a mass balance for the oxygen mass that's brought to below the building and is then available for biodegradation. So quite a novel, I think, a great way of looking at this, something that George Duvall put together, actually. I should acknowledge that. He developed the model. The BioVapor model. And then third, you can specify the aerobic depth, if you know that. So the methods are related, and I think the methodology is, you know, quite unique to the BioVapor model. I mentioned that source concentrations are really important, and they are, and know that, you know, gasoline sites, that they're primarily aliphatic compounds that are present in soil gas. Aromatics often represent a small percentage, typically less than 10%. So BioVapor allows you to input the full range. So that's really important because those compounds are biodegrading and represent an oxygen demand. So your chemical analysis, should reflect the oxygen demand, appropriate TPH analyses, gasoline range organic, diesel range organics, also measure, methane. And so all of those compounds should be included when conducting your biovapor modeling. You would not just model, for example, benzene. We're wrapping up, moving quickly through this. I recognize, again, our objective here is just to touch on the modeling and its use, provide you some key points. This is a little case study for a dissolved source site in Salt Lake City, Utah. Shallow dissolved hydrocarbon separation distance was potentially as small as 4 feet. The concentrations are relatively high there, but really, based on all the evidence, the impacts were just related to dissolved phase. We conducted this modeling kind of retrospectively, so we kind of looked at it after the site had gone through the process. This was the site where there were measured subslab concentrations. And the model predictions are shown there. The dashed line, the red line, is the benzene vapor concentration from the J&E model, no bio. And then the bio vapor results are shown as well, together with the oxygen. And so a little bit difficult to see based on the scaling, but the measured subslab was less than the predicted concentration, so the model was conservative. And so I mentioned that this site did go through a process of subslab and indoor air testing, but it provided an added line of evidence for limited or no concern with respect to indoor air. And so here's where modeling could be used to maybe support that subslab indoor air assessment, provide some confidence if you use reasonable values and you're showing, wow, that the concentrations really are predicted to degrade significantly. We don't really expect an indoor air concern, so help support the overall assessment. And this next slide here is just kind of a similar exercise, but an LNAPL site is a research study we actually conducted a number of years ago for New Jersey DEP. A shallow LNAPL source, so 5 feet, certainly less than the required separation distance for screening out. Pretty high source concentrations, as shown there. We modeled isooctane, or 2,2,4-trimethylpentane, as well as benzene, and pretty high isooctane concentrations to start with. It's quite as soluble as benzene. It behaves slightly differently, doesn't attenuate quite as rapidly, generally speaking, as compared to benzene, but it's also not a compound that's regulated in most jurisdictions, and so it's not a risk driver. So the important point, though, I'd like to make here is that the measured indoor air and slub were less than the predicted concentration. So the model, based on sort of the best estimates with respect to degradation rates and so forth, was conservative. Again, the modeling added a line of evidence for evaluating the background and predicted the aromatic and aliphatic behavior relatively well. Actually, the benzene was degraded and supported through subslab. Whereas the isooctane, actually in this instance here, there was a complete pathway in some elevated indoor air concentration. So here's an example where maybe modeling could be used to understand the relative behavior of compounds and, again, give a little bit better understanding of potential for vapor intrusion. To sum up, determine if the modeling is applicable. Does it have a purpose at your site? Identify the appropriate model. In many cases, biovapor will be an appropriate choice. Ask the right questions about your model results. Look at sensitivity analysis inputs and source concentrations, and I think that at least is a start to when you're evaluating a modeling assessment. And so with that, I'm going to pass it off to Dave Folks, who's going to continue on vapor control and site management.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ian, and hello, everyone. Excuse me. I think by now we all appreciate that because of biodegradation, a lot of petroleum vapor intrusion sites are going to be screened out or found not to be a problem during the investigation process if you have to do that. And not too many will make it all the way to this stage of the game with requiring vapor control. But some of them do. I've certainly come across a few where the source is close enough to the foundations where you have to do something about it. So it's still a good thing to be aware of and to follow along here. For this last segment, what I'm going to be focusing on is how factors unique to PVI will affect mitigation. And what I really mean there is how petroleum VI mitigation can be different from mitigating good old-fashioned chlorinated VI like PCE or TCE. I'll talk about the general strategies that you can employ and also some specific technologies, and we'll use some examples that you can actually participate with, so that'll be fun. And I'll talk about where you can find more information in the guidance. So maybe the most important slide in all of this, what makes PVI mitigation different from chlorinated VI mitigation? And really the biggest factor, and I think most of you appreciate this, is that petroleum contamination is usually less extensive because of the being lighter than water and biodegradable, and it's easier to mitigate than chlorinateds. What that means is that sometimes the cleanup itself can be our primary way to deal with the vapor pathway, and that's usually not the case for chlorinateds. A second factor that's a little different, and as you've been hearing all about, is that bioattenuation means that the vertical distance between your building and your source matters, and at least for new construction, that's possibly something you can factor in there. Make sure that you do have that vertical separation so it's not a concern. Of course, all of this is really boiling down to oxygen below the building. And if you can, in your mitigation or other efforts, get more oxygen below the building, then through bioattenuation, that's going to enhance anything else you're doing. And perhaps through soil venting, SVE, or building design, aerated floors, other things, you can do that. But it's not all good news. The one thing about petroleum vapor intrusion that is typically different from chemical vapor intrusion is that sometimes you can have explosive conditions, at least below the slab, and you have to be careful when you're working in that environment. So you have to take that into account. Just stepping back at a very high level, our strategies for dealing with petroleum vapor intrusion issues are pretty much the same categories that you have with any environmental remediation, and that's the tools you have at your disposal are environmental remediation or source remediation, engineering controls, or in this case building mitigation, and institutional controls to try and prevent the exposure from occurring. And in my experience, we're often with PVI employing, at least to some degree, a mixture of these tools. Of course, figure 6.1 down there on the left is an example of an environmental remediation approach that might be applicable. to PVI, and on the right we have a subslab venting approach that would be a building mitigation example. And the key point here at the bottom is, while you're thinking about long-term cleanup, don't forget about short-term risk, which can include explosion potential. All right, so let's roll up our sleeves a bit and look at some specific approaches through examples. And in a minute, I'll have Juliana open up a poll so you can actually play along here. But let me describe the scenario first. We have a pretty common situation. I expect most of you have run into this. A leaking UST has contaminated soil in the Vados zone, hasn't really had much in the way of groundwater impacts. And because of its proximity to a building, we have levels in the indoor air that are above residential but below commercial screening levels. So, and we're, of course, not able to screen this site out in this particular case. So, Juliana, if you could open the poll for me. And you might have to scroll down a bit to expose all your poll, but just pick two or three of the technologies below that you think are most applicable in this situation to dealing with the vapor issues. And I've, in blue, I've shown the major categories: remediation, mitigation, institutional controls, and in green, some of the specific technologies that you might apply, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with from other applications. Where remediation is in the lead, and we get a little smattering of all the other approaches. All right, good. Well, let's close the poll, Juliana. And what I'm going to do is show you what we think here at ITRC. First of all, we don't think evacuation of the building is particularly necessary in this case at these levels. And we do agree with most of you that remediation makes a lot of sense, because we can certainly do that fairly quickly here and potentially eliminate the need for any building controls. The only other thing I'd like to highlight is that we're only above residential, not commercial, and chances are in this location that is a commercial building, so institutional controls preventing residential use would work pretty well here too. It may not be your best option, but certainly something that would work. All right, well, let's go on to something a little more challenging, where our, in example two, where our UST has resulted in NAPL getting under our building, and certainly can't screen this one out based on vertical screening distances. Still, indoor air is only above residential and below commercial screening levels. So what do we do in this scenario? Juliana, we'll go to the poll. Same thing, you know, two or three things that you think, not necessarily what you need to do for the entire site remedy, but for vapor control in particular, what's the best strategy for dealing with vapors? We got a lot of remediation advocates here, a few more building mitigation. One of the things that I always notice in these polls is the fact that a lot of people are picking a lot of different things, so there's, you know, different ways to skin this cat. So remediation slightly in the lead over mitigation, and then ICs. Okay, Juliana, we'll close that. And I'll give you what we think here in a second. All right, again, not an emergency. We're not remediation fans in this particular case. You probably will need to do remediation, but for vapor, we think it's going to take too long to get soil vapor levels down below levels you don't have to worry about. So either building mitigation or institutional controls are probably going to be your main defense against PVI in this particular building until your remediation is complete. All right, what we got? One more example. It's the same contamination scenario as the last example, but now it's it's an undeveloped site, and we plan to develop it, put new buildings on there in the near future, but we have this contamination issue to deal with. So you're the developer or the consultant for the developer. What's your strategy for dealing with the vapor here? Okay, Juliana. And same rules apply. We have a broader spectrum, I say, of choices appearing in our poll this time, which is probably, I think, applicable here. You have more options for dealing with this. Pretty well, nice and even across there. Okay, let's close the poll, Juliana. It's all the time you guys get because consulting's a dog-eat-dog world. And I'll just forward this to our suggested approach. So, like you, we think you can really approach this three different ways or a combination. If you can remediate it before development, that's great. Perhaps you can create a bioattenuation zone by your grading plan to get enough. Actually, with an apple, you'll probably need more than 5 feet. But that's a possibility. Institutional controls requiring mitigation if remediation is not complete in time would probably be appropriate. And then ultimately preemptive mitigation, because with new construction you can certainly do things fairly economically these days that, and particularly for PVI, that you it's more difficult with existing construction. All right, so that was our fast run through technologies and strategies, and really focusing more on the strategy here. You can find a lot more information on what I've just talked about in Chapter 6, and I'll point you to Appendix J, which has a lot of good information on building controls, mitigation technologies, which are applicable not just to PVI, but to chemical or any type of VI. So I would encourage you to use this for any kind of vapor intrusion situation. And then we talked about community engagement a bit before, but the mitigators are the people that are most likely to get up close and personal with the building occupants. So you're probably going to get asked questions, and it's a really good idea to be prepared to answer them. So the ITRC guidance in Appendix K has some frequently asked questions, fact sheets that answer these kinds of questions that you want to have handy and have read yourself, and also think about who you want to have answer the questions and who people should be directed to. And then to summarize all of this, I'm going to circle right back around to what I think is the most important point of all of this, and that's that PVI is a little different from chemical VI that many of you are probably familiar with. And more than anything else, you just have more options available. Remediation is a much bigger part of your toolkit. The ability to make use of the bioattenuation process through just getting more oxygen under your building is something that is different and you should think about. Combining radiation like SVE or soil venting, letting it do double duty is something you can consider and should consider as well. as long as you remember that we're above LEL levels, and it's not just petroleum. It can be methane. Often that's, in my experience, it's usually the methane that's the problem with shallow NAPL contamination. So you want to take care of that. And bottom line is, think outside the box. Don't do what you've always done just because it worked for chemical VI. You might have other things you can do here. And read the PVI guidance frequently and often. So with that, I'll turn this back over to Matt from Michigan DEQ to wrap things up.
Thanks, Dave. So now that you've attended today's training, we hope that you feel confident and you know when and how to use ITRC's PVI training document. We hope that you have a better understanding of the importance role that biodegradation plays in the PVI pathway in contrast to CVI or chlorinated solvent contaminated sites. We hope you also are aware that the CSM plays an important component and that you understand that there's key components to a CSM and that you're aware that the ITRC document provides you some great examples on some key sites. We hope that you've learned how to apply ITRC's PVI 8-step decision process to screen the sites for the PVI pathway, that you take action if your site does not initially screen out, and you know what those options are through investigation, modeling, and eventually, if necessary, implementing a vapor control and site management strategy. Plus, the final thing is we hope that you've learned or you understand that the ITRC PVI document also has some great outreach materials to help you know when and how to engage with stakeholders. What you see on slide 117 is a list of the sites or states where ITRC is actively being incorporated in state guidance, either current or draft. And this is an outreach that's expanding all the time. We are glad to help state regulators as an ITRC PVI team bring training and opportunities to your state if possible. If you're interested, please let us know and we can work on getting one closer. So looking forward, like Juliana said, in October 10th and 11th in the Seattle area, we will be doing or holding an ITRC PVI two-day classroom training. It is more in-depth training and information about the PVI pathway. It goes more into the science behind it, provides the background information and that you may be interested in. It gives you practice in applying the ITRC vertical separation distance approach and the investigation strategy. You get to participate with a wide, diverse group of environmental professionals and working through the case studies. So we hope that you would be interested in attending. And again, we have a date set for October 10th and 11th. Juliana talked about it, the registration opening soon. So please, we look forward to meeting you there. Again, if you want more information or you're interested in seeing about the possibility of bringing it to your state, also feel free to contact us at that email. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Juliana so we can go through our second question and answer break. And before I sign off, though, I'd like to thank you all for attending.
Thank you, Matt. We are going to have time for questions, so anyone is welcome to send in those questions using the Q&A pod. Before we get to those, I'll point out our links to additional resources and our feedback form. We look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback. We really do use the information. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending. So if you're interested in a certificate, there's a box at the bottom where you say you certify you attended. Once you check that box and submit the feedback form, the system generates that certificate for you. And right now, that's the only way to get it. So be sure to check the box at the bottom when you submit your feedback.
Juliana, I just would like to point out that US EPA has released the PVI screen. Thanks for that heads up in March of this year, just recently released. And I think if it's possible, you're going to send that link to everyone?
So you can watch the Q&A pod. I can send out little notes using that Q&A pod. So I'm going to go ahead and send that message to everyone right now. So you will have that link coming up in that Q&A pod.
Thank you.
Thank you. Several questions have come in. For Dave's example site, was this a commercial building? Would you recommend something different if it was a residential building?
I'm not sure what that was in reference to.
For your examples where we did our quizzes.
My famous building. If it was, well, certainly if it was a residential building, then you wouldn't have the option of institutional controls, but everything else would still apply. It would depend on how quickly, of course, that you could do remediation, but with soil vapor extraction, you can essentially apply a building control very quickly.
If most of the vapor at these sites is from aliphatic rather than aromatic compounds, why is benzene used as the reference? Is it more toxic?
Part of it, I think. maybe some slight differences in the behavior of different compounds. The aliphatic compounds have actually some pretty high biodegradation rates, but benzene is still present at relatively significant concentrations. If you recall during the screening part of the presentation, I presented the benzene vapor data and near source. They are elevated, and so I think just when you look at the screening limits, which are quite low for benzene, and you put all that together, it is the risk driver. That's the compound that falls out as key still for, even though, relatively speaking, compositionally, a relatively small fraction of the overall mixture of vapors.
Can you evaluate the effect of air sparging as creating a vapor problem in a nearby building?
I'll assume that's kind of a mitigation question. I think generally you, in my experience, you assume that it can, and that you, in my experience, you either have monitoring to just make sure that's not the case, or in some cases, soil vapor extraction to counteract it. And I don't know if you have anything to add, Ian.
No, I think that's good, Dave. Yeah.
Well, this is Matt. In my experience, we have seen cases where they didn't do like Dave and Ian just talked about, where they tried to just do sparging, and we've actually seen it cause troubles in surrounding houses as well. So to answer your question, we have seen it occur. But it's usually when people do not take that added step of doing an SVE system or the monitoring that's associated with it.
What concentrations of benzene should be considered background in a commercial setting?
George, can you speak to that with respect to your knowledge of literature?
What concentrations of benzene could be considered background? There is information from EPA on relative background concentrations of benzene in indoor air and outdoor air. Precise numbers, I can't remember off the top of my head. Most of the screening we're doing is not in air, but in soil gas, at which point we're looking more for attenuation than actual relative concentrations compared to background.
George, this is Lauren. I would just add to what you said. So George referred to an EPA, the EPA background guidance or background document, and database, and that's for primarily residential structures. So for commercial, industrial, State of New York has an appendix in their guidance that has some historical data that they've compiled on background concentrations in a variety of different settings. Rich Ragu with Haley and Aldrich has been doing some studies in commercial buildings and schools on background concentrations. He's presented that. Certainly, if you want to shoot us an email, or Juliana can relay it over to us, and we can provide you with the resources that are available for background concentrations. But in commercial, industrial type of settings, very, very highly variable, given the different types of processes and storage and use of petroleum-containing products.
I think Lauren said it best when it's highly variable. When we do see, for indoor air sampling, when we do see benzene, it typically, as a background concentration, hasn't been above acceptable air concentrations or regulatory criteria. We might see some low levels, especially in the highly industrialized areas, but we don't see it in generally in a lot of locations, including in our indoor air samples. But it is highly variable. It obviously depends on what the use is, where the building's located. I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into it. So I don't think that there's a generic, what I guess I'm saying is I don't think that there's a generic value that would apply to every site that you could just say, the normal background concentration of benzene is that. Even in Michigan, we have an air monitoring network. We don't see a standard concentration across even that. So I would expect to see a large variation. And I think it's why most states recommend that you do ambient air sampling when you do indoor air sampling, that you pair it so that you have that comparison.
The thing I'd add to that, Matt, is I had one case in New York where one of the HVAC intakes was located in the parking garage. So you want to make sure you get your an ambient air sample from that near that intake, because it was a source.
With multiple and undetermined contaminant sources, can you suggest a reference for individual BTEX compound percentages to suggest age of the contaminant?
Yeah, I could answer that. The answer is no.
Do you have anything more than?
It's pretty varied. I mean, to age date, what it sounds like, age date a release based on BTEX composition? No.
Is there another way to age date? Do you have any?
People who do forensics, is there other ways to age date? Yes. They can be useful. They can also be wrong.
Yeah, I don't think they're conclusive, I think is what George is trying to say, too. There are ways to do it. I don't know that we've ever concluded. I don't know that you can break it apart.
Have you looked at vapor intrusion from a gas well or well condensate, upstream well near buildings?
I have. There have been sites where there have been concerns with methane and methane under pressure. I mean, it's a completely different kind of conceptual model and not really what we're addressing in the course. I mean, there may be some commonalities with respect to behavior and degradation. Methane degrades certainly rapidly in the subsurface, but a complicating factor could be pressure and advective migration. But it's probably not something we can speak to with much or provide much beneficial advice because it's just such a, you know, kind of a different area. It's just something that one would need to look at on a site-specific basis and, you know, apply some of the principles that we've presented and take it from there.
Do you recommend investigating vapors for sites that only have concentrations of TPH without concentrations of the individual compounds?
I think, and George, jump in, please, as well, but my first thought is that sites should be appropriately investigated for, you know, soil and groundwater impacts, and then the screening process can be applied. And part of that site investigation involves looking at the potential contaminants of concern, and partly it's driven by regulatory requirements with respect to chemicals that should be analyzed. But, you know, one would typically look at, you know, a list of hydrocarbons, including BTECs, and then fractions, which are often regulatorily defined. And so there does need to be some minimum investigation conducted to apply this screening process.
I mean, and within the context of this guide, there is some decision between residual or LNAPL source vapor versus dissolved vapor. Yes, you can use those type of total concentrations as one type of screen. For the evaluation of risk itself, probably not, because the bulk composition of vapor can be variable enough that it's not telling you enough information to get an estimate of risk.
And I know Hawaii, I think, looks at TPH without doing the individual fractionations. And that might be one place that you can look for that as a resource. But I know most states don't look at just TPH, that they look at the individual compounds to evaluate risk. And TPH may be part of a line of evidence on whether you have NAPL present or not, or can be used in that kind of context.
Thank you. We are out of time, and I'm sorry, there were a couple questions we never got to. So if you would like those questions answered, send those to training@ITRC.com.